now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Hauck.
Well, good evening, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. I am Dr. James Hauck, and if you would like more information about me or to leave me your comments about tonight's show, I invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. You all run that all together. So www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And if later on in the show you would like to join in the conversation on tonight's topic, you can call the toll-free line. It's 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And like I said, I'll be taking your calls after the break. And these broadcasts are now podcasted in case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows. And they are now available for download on Audible and Amazon Music. So I'm very happy to be with you here tonight and every other Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Right. And for those of you tuning in for the first time, I just want to say welcome to the show. Each and every broadcast is dedicated to the integration of spirituality and our mental health, and the themes that are brought in or the stories that are shared and so forth accentuate this, this integration, this combination of our spirituality and our mental health. And just in case you cannot spend the entire hour with me this evening, that's okay. Like I said, you can listen to these broadcasts, you know, the podcasts, or download them again. So I invite you to do that. And earlier this evening, I spent some time outside enjoying the nice, crisp fall air that we're having on the East Coast and taking in the full moon and all its brightness. It's certainly spectacular, to say the least. And every time there is a full moon, it always reminds us to be open and receptive to the light we see and the awareness of energy that is evident in our mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual bodies. So I hope you get out there and spend some time with the moon tonight. Just sit quietly with your thoughts and just reflect on the good things in your life and offer a simple word of thanks. Well, you know, I get asked this question all the time, and it's this, you know, how does one reclaim one's authenticity? You know, and like, where is it? Where do you look for it? Where do you go? And so forth. And before we delve into that, you know, I just want to remind everybody that it takes great courage and inner strength to change from what is known and comfortable to something that is fresh and new. And this is what we are doing when we go to reclaim our authenticity. It's something that we truly are at our core. But at times, we have to remove things in our lives that are just simply getting in the way of being able to know ourselves for who we are, or let's say, to be reminded of who we always have been. And this includes reclaiming our authenticity. And so when you think about it, that which is unknown often contains our greatest potential. And therefore, to seek our potential by risking change, this is what great spiritual leaders have often called the path of true greatness, because such action brings great favor and untold blessings. Now, unfortunately, we often do not see courage in ourselves because we want to hang on to the past, or perhaps we can't even imagine something better in our lives, let alone discovering who we truly are. So in tonight's broadcast, I'm using courage here as the strength we already possess that empowers us to let go of negative attitudes, traumatic aspects, and distorted perceptions that no longer serve us or keep us wounded or victimized, and then taking on something better, something more life-giving and more authentic to who we truly are, and again, who we have always been. Or, as my teacher puts it, until there is an acknowledgement of our spiritual nature, we will not do the work that is necessary to eradicate the ignorance that binds us. In fact, we are going to continue to experience the changing joys and sorrows that are associated with the temporary and false states of our consciousness, and just to seek gratifying pleasures that only seek to soothe our sorrows. Well, as I had mentioned a couple of weeks ago, that September is Suicide Prevention and Awareness Month. Suicide has a far-reaching and is often regarded as a very uncomfortable topic to discuss. And there continues to be a stigma out there around suicide and even loved ones who are grieving the loss of, you know, a family member or a friend or a coworker who had committed suicide. And even though there's a stigma out there, it's not like it was. And because of this social stigma, suicide and suicide ideation are considered topics to be avoided. So much so that almost half the people who die by suicide really deny any suicide ideation in the weeks, even months leading up to their attempt and success. Now, one of the myths out there is that, well, if we talk about suicide, that's going to put somebody at risk. And that's just not so. You know, just on the contrary. It actually opens the door for people to truly express what they're thinking and feeling, hopefully without fear or shame, all within a very safe context. And still, psychological, emotional, physical, even spiritual pain isn't always obvious. You know, it's something that we see on the outside and we look at our scars or the scars of you know, people around us. But there are some emotional scars that are on the inside that people do not show. But actually, most suicidal people do show some signs that they're thinking about suicide. And these signs may appear in everyday conversations or maybe through their actions or in social media posts. And so as we're winding down the end of September here, and as I said, September is Suicide Prevention and Awareness Month, let us be reminded that suicide is ongoing all the months, all year long, and so forth. And very simple, you know, to report any kind of suicide ideation or somebody who's feeling suicidal, or maybe even yourself. You're listening to this broadcast and you're wondering why you tuned in, and perhaps this is the reason why. Because the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is as simple as dialing 988, and that's available up and running 24 hours a day, and it's both in English and Spanish. So it's a simple, you know, just on your phone, 988, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Well, I'm sure at one point or another, you've heard the expression, silence is golden. But have you ever stopped to consider exactly what that means? Now, a textbook definition of this expression is pretty much this. Keeping one's mouth shut is a great virtue, as in, don't tell anyone else about it because silence is golden. And it's kind of interesting, this phrase was first recorded back in 1848, and it's actually part of a much older proverb that goes like this, speech is silver, and silence is golden. Now, at first thought, it appears that this sounds like pretty good advice, but it's not a universal truth, because it's not always advantageous to be silent. Especially when one has been forced into silence or bullied into silence or told not to tell anybody or threatened to keep quiet. And this is one of the aspects that victims are often told by their abusers or oppressors, that if they talk, there will be consequences. And as a result, many people are made to believe that there's no alternative but to just suffer in silence and bear their psychological, emotional, physical, and spiritual pain alone. And yet, how many people do you know suffer in silence? This is not just a cultural expression, but rather many people who suffer from mental health illnesses or trauma in silence is often the result of because they don't know how to put into words the depth of their pain, suffering, and relentless misery. Well, my encounters and my understanding of silence has really expanded over the years, especially when I first started to research intergenerational trauma. And one of the things that I discovered was that there is a word in the Korean language referred to as Han, H-A-N, Han. And you've heard me talk about Han before, and but for those of you tuning in, Han is one of these words that captures feelings of sorrow, oppression, unavenged injustices, and isolation. And it's really hard to truly explain because there isn't an American equivalent to this word. You know, it just has many meanings. But Han also expresses a continuous and relentless anguish of a people as a whole, especially the people who are considered powerlessness or the vulnerable in society. And an example of this can be seen as another group of people or another power wants to come in and attempts to erase everything about another group of people, wants to erase their language, their culture, their identity. But still, one definition I came across describes Han as an unfathomable wound. It's basically a rupture of the soul that's caused by abuse or exploitation or injustice and violence. And when an aching soul is wounded again and again by an external violence, the victim suffers a deep, unrelenting ache. Now, the wound produced by such repeated abuse and injustice is found in the depths of the soul. And although our society has improved over the decades, society still tends to victimize victims. So what do you do when your woundedness goes beyond words? And the theologian Dorothy Soleil, she writes that pain that cannot be given a voice is pain that cannot be healed. That pain that cannot be given a voice is pain that cannot be healed. So what do you do when your woundedness goes beyond words? That your native language just simply doesn't have the words to get at the relentless suffering that you are facing. Well, let's take, for example, depression, okay? Depression affects nearly 16 million Americans every year, and the stigma attached to the mental illness like depression is very real, and it causes many people to suffer in silence, even to this day. And this is especially true for men. You know, society tells them to, well, you know, keep it inside, hide your feelings, don't show weakness. Keep a stiff upper lip, be the man of the family, and so on and so forth, almost as if showing emotions is a sign of weakness. And yet, it does take courage, as I talked about a little while ago, to openly talk to others about your suffering, because others may perhaps see you as vulnerable. And generally, it takes a lot of motivation and a tolerance to really, let's say, pull through in a period of suffering or hardship. However, I don't necessarily think suffering in silence is sustainable, nor does it need to be that way. And this is something that both psychologists and psychiatrists and therapists and clinicians out there, anybody who's in a helping relationship field, you know, is well aware that typically trauma and silence almost always go hand in hand. It's not easy to talk out loud about the thing hurting us. And the majority of the time, if an experience becomes traumatic and overwhelming, it actually blocks the brain from accessing language. So before launching into a discussion of trauma, it's always good to first explore how we not only take in our experiences, but also how and why some experiences remain stuck inside of us and affect how we see ourselves and others and the world. Because for the most part, people who experience something stressful or traumatic are encouraged to talk about it. I mean, how many times have you heard, "Let it out, talk about it, you'll feel better," as we try to make sense of what's happened to us? Now, depending on the severity of the experience, some have extreme difficulty being able to put into words what has happened to us. And this might be related to something life-threatening, or when we are overcome with emotion and we just can't find the words. If you recall, if you've ever seen the Tom Hanks movie Captain Phillips, and this was about Somalia pirates taking over his ship, and just the trauma that he experienced, and just the terror that he experienced. And don't want to ruin the movie for you, but he was rescued, and you know, the would-be captors were all killed, and he's... The last scene in the movie is that he is on a Red Cross ship or a rescue ship, and the nurse is checking him out, making sure, you know, just, are you okay? And can you tell me your name? And Tom Hanks, in my opinion, gives one of the best performances of what it means to be so traumatized in a life-threatening event that he shows how difficult it is to put his experience into words, because he is clearly in shock and trauma has just overwhelmed all his senses. I mean, it is just incredible, the performance that he gives. But that is what's going on here. You know, this is what's traumatic about trauma. You know, it overloads our senses. And again, you know, it just makes it very difficult to put what happened to us into language. Now, it's kind of interesting also that the purpose of telling and retelling our stories and why we're encouraged to do this is to cause a psychological shift, let's say, to occur between the amygdala and the hippocampus in the brain. And for example, you know, just on any given day, all information comes into our brains from what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and intuitively. And this information then enters the thalamus. This is all part of the midbrain, you know, which relays this information to the prefrontal cortex area of the brain. And the only sensory information that is not relayed by the thalamus is information related to smell. And if the experience is new information for us, the thalamus determines, is this a threat? And all the while, the prefrontal cortex determines the best course of action. In other words, are you going to flee? Are you going to fight? Are you going to faint? So on and so forth. And yet, if the information that is, you know, being picked up through the senses, being sent through into the brain, if that information is anything closely resembling a past trauma, then this organ in our brain, the thalamus, is triggered to interpret the information as a new traumatic event and through the lens of the past. So here comes Han again. And again, past traumas may be anything related to a life-threatening experience, or the untimely death of a loved one, or being bullied at school or work, or feeling shame and guilt for not living up to another person's expectations, whatever it might be. But when events and experiences overwhelm us, that's trauma. And if a memory of a past trauma is triggered by a certain smell or odor, then the hippocampus relays this information. Now, based on this relay, or the thalamus, and or the hippocampus's interpretation, these signals are sent to the amygdala, which, again, regulates our emotional response to any experience appropriately, such as feeling happy eating our favorite food. But if the information is viewed as trauma, then the amygdala has this disproportionate emotional response, such as anxiety, fear, dissociation, or etc. So again, for example, if a person has had a traumatic experience around seeing or smelling their own blood, or any new experience surrounding blood, then will trigger the amygdala to kick into anxiety, fear, dissociation, or whatever. Okay. And so the signals are then also sent to the brainstem, which gets us ready for that action. So what often happens between the hippocampus and the amygdala, it's kind of like a tug of war to see which organ is going to control the memory. You see, on one hand, the hippocampus wants to create new memories. And on the other hand, the amygdala wants to interpret everything from the template of past emotional and physiological interpretations. And this could be why we're sitting in an office, you know, doing work or minding our own business, and we hear screeching tires off in a distance, which could trigger a memory of when we were in an accident and we remember the screeching tires. And we might automatically, sitting in that office, assume the worst because, well, this happened to us before. So to move beyond this wounded template that we may be carrying around called trauma, we have to first put our traumatic stories into words via, let's say, verbal, writings, drawing, music, even sitting in silence. Because let's first keep in mind here that beneath the words one chooses to say is the breath. And where there is breath, there is vibration. And behind the sound, there is vibration. And where there is silence, there is also vibration. And where you find any vibration, that's where you're going to find the energy. And so healing trauma that cannot be expressed through words, one must first transform the energy. And a powerful means of doing this is through the breath that produces the sound. If you're a fan of the rock group The Eagles, Already Gone is probably one of my favorite songs. Came from their 1974 album On the Border. And there's one line in that particular song, Already Gone, that says, "How often do we live our lives in chains and we never know we have the key?" And as I mentioned earlier and in previous broadcasts, that this discovery of what lies within us is basically one of my deep-seated beliefs, that everybody already comes in the world, already gifted with skills and talents and personalities and so forth, in order to discover them and cultivate them and use them to benefit others. So as long as we have breath, we have the ability to heal. Change the vibration of sound through toning or chanting or humming or song, and you change its energy. Now, down through history, often the greatest spiritual teachers and gurus out there are the ones who enable and empower us to discover that potential of what lies within us. And a guru, a title typically found in Hinduism, is really more than a teacher. You know, traditionally, a guru is a revered figure to one's students, with the guru serving as a counselor who helps mold values and shares this experiential knowledge. And being that inspirational source and who helps in the spiritual evolution of a student. And a guru is also one spiritual guide, one who helps, you know, a person to discover the same potentialities that a guru has already realized. And whether it's within Western or Eastern cultures, these effective teachers and mentors and leaders throughout history have been characterized by those who help pull out of others the very best of themselves. In fact, they help us to be healed and empowered to tell our stories differently, to tell our stories by changing the energy. And the reason why we are able to do this is because an excellent teacher, a guru, a spiritual leader will not allow others to settle for mediocrity. You know, even if there's resistance on our part, they're patient, knowing that everybody is on their own spiritual journey, because everybody arrives at their truth sooner or later. But instead, effective teachers, mentors, and leaders empower others to discover greatness in themselves and others. You know, effective leaders never seek to control others. That is a huge distinction. But instead, teachers, mentors, leaders that who are very effective, they know how to release. They seek to release and hope that we have the courage then to embrace that freedom and continue on. Because these teachers and mentors and leaders and spiritual guides and gurus, the reason they can do this is because they themselves have discovered how to live in forgiveness and gratitude and love on a daily basis. But sometimes we might find an effective teacher or a mentor or leader, and we might become complacent, believing that all we need to do is hang around them and ask for one blessing after another. But let's not kid ourselves. We have our own spiritual inner work to do in terms of cultivating our own forgiveness, gratitude, and love in our daily life. And we do have to listen to our teachers and gurus and mentors, not to what they're saying, but also to their method of how they're imparting that truth to us. And often, quite often, the most effective means of teaching come from people who are and were great storytellers. From plots and narratives, analogies, and irony, storytellers have shared ancient wisdom that has ignited powerful transformation in those who, let's say, have ears to hear, so to speak. And nothing, I'm convinced of this, nothing touches our hearts as when a great teacher shares a story. And storytelling is one of the basic and yet most powerful means of imparting truth, because we take in those stories, not necessarily through our ears, but mainly in our hearts. And it's in those moments that we often feel whereby the moral of the story has reached in, grabbed us by the soul, and is never going to let us go. Well, perhaps you remember what it was like when you were younger and your mother or your father or another person read stories to you. We sat there listening intently to the words and allowing those stories to form mental images and colors and sounds and fantasies in our minds. In fact, I mean, how often did we sit on the edge of our seats or the edge of our beds, and, or in some cases just laid in our beds in anticipation for what would come next? Well, storytelling and listening to stories are not just for the young. As a mental health clinician and a pastoral professional, you know, storytelling and listening to stories go hand in hand. I mean, some people are better storytellers than others, let's face it. You know, some stick to a well-rehearsed script, making sure every little detail is shared. And others are kind of all over the place with their thoughts, leaving out important details and making up others. And then there are some who have never shared the story of their lives with someone. In fact, some people have never been given the chance, or let's say never been given the permission, to share their experiences, those stories that lie deep within, underneath the emotional wounds and the scars that are hidden from the rest of the world. And when this occurs, helping people find their narrative empowers them to also find their healing. Well, one of the therapies out there that I use quite a bit with clients is called narrative therapy. It's a style of therapy that helps people become, as I call, an intuitive expert in their own lives. And in narrative therapy, there is an emphasis on our stories that develop over the time and carry us through our lives. And narrative therapy is very effective because it's the kind of therapy that views people as separate from their problems. Again, think of storytelling. And an example of this would be to help a person separate what has happened to an individual and his interpretations or assumptions from who they are as a person who has value, dignity, and worth. And there are actually three benefits to this approach. And the first is to place any unspoken moments of a person's life into their current story. In other words, get the whole story out. Get the whole context involved. The second is that this method also helps people connect to the emotional content and retell their stories, not just from a head center, but also a heart center, combining the head and the heart. And the last is that you really help people construct new perspectives and insights in relation to how they tell their stories. And this is what makes effective teachers and sages and gurus and leaders, is that they know how to enter into another person's life story, become part of it, and transform them into embracing who they are and the potential for them to be something they may even have yet to realize. Well, let's see. You know, in thinking about how we tell our stories, you know, you might have done some pretty awful things in your life, but does that make you an awful person? No, you're a person who came into this world already equipped and graced with everything you need, as I said before, but perhaps you have not recognized and embraced your fullest potential. And therefore, you're a person with value, dignity, and worth, of course, but there are times when you act in ignorance of that. You're just not aware of what you're not aware of. And part of healing from our past not only involves telling our stories, but also reclaiming our empowerment to rewrite our stories that are now life-empowering and affirming. And we don't achieve this empowerment from an embellished, delusional story that you know, ties up our stories nicely in a bow. Well, in addition to narrative therapy, another method I use in helping people tell their story actually comes from an Austrian-born physician, psychotherapist, and pioneer of individual psychology, none other than Alfred Adler. And he lived in the latter part of the 1800s and died somewhere around 1937, I believe. And he believed that stories not only provided the form to our earliest memories, but also these stories became, in a sense, a blueprint for how we live our lives in relation to others, even to this day. And so he developed this technique, just earliest memories technique, in that every time we remember a story from our childhood, in order to tell that story appropriately, we must always ask ourselves, okay, as a 3 or 4 year old, having remembered this and wanting to tell this story, I am And then you would fill in the blank with how you see yourself back then as a 3 or 4 year old. And others are, again, filling in the context as a 3 or 4 year old going through that particular memory. And the world is, again, fill in the blank. And then, therefore, I will, as a 3 or 4 year old, do this or such. And each time we do this with an early memory, we become aware of the thought patterns and perspectives that we have attached to, as well as how this attachment affects how we tell a story. Now, granted, we're not going to be able to recall every experience, but for those moments that stand out to us, they do serve as a means, as the unconscious logic about how we see ourselves and our relationship with others and the motivation for our behavior today. Well, if you're like me, and I've shared this story before, but this will drive the point home further, that as a boy, I remember listening to the same family stories at picnics and holidays and other family gatherings. And I heard these accounts so often that by the time I was a teenager, I could recite these stories word for word. And now, with the benefit of hindsight, I also understand that not only did the details not change, but also the storyteller's interpretation and the attitudes remain the same. In fact, I quickly became aware that there was always an underlying tone of helplessness or bitterness or sadness and resentment that drove how the story was told. And in fact, kind of ironically, it's almost as if the story was not being told correctly if these negative emotions were absent. So the first thing we need to do is to listen to how our stories are told. And yes, facts and figures, names and places are important. But what's even more significant is how we tell our stories. You know, the words that we use, the words that are filled with symbols and metaphors, words that are positive or negative, affirming or frightful, that they are filled with emotion, powerful images, and energy. And in counseling others struggling with intergenerational trauma, I've noticed that when people have not been able to transform that negative energy around tragic events, their stories are told the same each time, every time. And when healing occurs within the greater context of generations, people tell their stories much differently from a healthier, more holistic perspective. And the reason why we can tell our stories differently is because much of the healing involves becoming aware of those former negative perceptions and the self-talk that no longer serve us. See, we're changing the energy by changing our words. As the healing goes deeper, more of the transformation occurs. We will always remember the facts and figures of what has happened to us, but how we tell the story changes. It's going to transform because we are no longer going to be telling our stories from a place of woundedness or pain or suffering. We're going to tell it from a place of healing and wholeness, peace, gratitude. In other words, we recognize how, you know, certain cognitive schemas have been draining our energy or distorting our perceptions and diminishing our potential for healthier relationships. And in fact, once we replace these with more transformative and life-giving perspectives, that what I call a starburst of energy heals all generations across time and space. And yet, it is what happens in the ordinary, or allowing room for the extraordinary acts of God in the ordinary everyday aspect of our lives. And this gives heed for us to pay attention, to have this awareness, and to have this understanding. Because you see, when we discover these unhealthy perspectives and attachments, we can also perhaps discover the root causes of our unforgiveness, pain, bitterness, and woundedness. And this is exactly where the inner work of unforgiveness, ingratitude, and bitterness begins. So now, when we begin to heal, as I said, our stories are now told from a healthier perspective, a place from one's inner peace and wholeness, and tapping into rediscovering our authenticity. Well, let me give you just a little exercise to do. I think you'll really enjoy this. If you want something tangible, or let's say a little bit of homework on this, this is something that is very powerful, and I subscribe to it all the time. It is not something that I cannot take credit for as coming up with, because I've benefited from somebody who came up with it. It's called Lectio Divina. And it's usually when a person takes a passage out of scripture, or may take another story or even a poem. And it's a process whereby you insert yourself into the passage of scripture or the story or the poem or whatever, and you begin by reading the story aloud, and then you read it aloud again. And the second time that you are reading it aloud, you listen for what phrases or words in the story or images in scripture come up for you. And then you read it again, but this time you intentionally place yourself in the passage by using your name, using a first-person pronoun such as I or we. And you keep doing that. And you read the story aloud again. And then you read the story aloud one more time. And over time, you begin to get a different perspective. And you allow that scripture or that story or that poem to really speak to you by putting yourself in the story and changing the perspective. See, it's the story is no longer out there, but now the story has become part of us. Or the scriptural passage that has just vivid images is no longer out there. It's inside of us. And this was something that I believe it was Michelangelo did in The Storm at the Sea, you know, the Sea of Galilee. It's a scripture where Jesus is in the boat. And, you know, he's asleep underneath, and the disciples, who most of them were fishermen, were out, you know, fishing out in the, you know, middle of the sea at night, and a storm came up, and they were scared. And Jesus was just down below, you know, just taking a nap, totally at peace. And they come down, they wake him up, and they say, "Master, Master, please do something. We're going to drown." And that's where Jesus stands up, and he just says to the ocean, to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind stopped, rain stopped, the waves stopped. And the disciples, I think they said something like, you know, "Who is this person that commands even the waves to obey him?" And when Michelangelo painted this painting of the storm at the sea, you count next time you come across this painting or a picture of it, count how many people are in the boat and how many disciples there are. Originally, Jesus picked 12 disciples, but there are 13 disciples in the boat with Jesus. And when asked about that, thinking a lot of people back in, you know, his day, you know, "Well, why'd you paint it wrong?" And you know, Michelangelo, he just said pretty much, "I didn't paint it wrong. I put myself in the boat with the others." And that's what happens in Lectio Divina. We put ourselves into a story, a passage of scripture or a poem or something, and we become part of the story. And we wrestle with what the characters wrestle with. We listen to, let's say, the waves that are crashing. or the cries of the disciples as they're filled with terror, thinking that they're going to drown, or whatever the story that you use. So think about your own stories for a minute, and think about how you tell them. And also think about to whom you have most often told your story. Sit for a while this coming week and think about the people who have caused you pain and disappointment, misery, or even heartbreak. And listen to the tone you use when you tell your story. Has anything changed from when you first started telling that story? And what if you told your story differently? What would change? Now, obviously, like I said, we can't go back and rewrite history. But what if we could change how we tell the story by inserting a different perspective or a wish? What would happen if, in thinking about the people in our stories, we would see them as wounded as well? What if we were able to see that instead of wishing them pain, we realize that they must have been in pain themselves? What if instead we wish them healing? Because that's what they need, just like us. How then would we tell our stories? Well, I imagine we would be telling those stories from a more intuitive place within ourselves that has certainly been awakened and blessed by its own taste of transformative grace. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Thanks for spending this hour with me this evening. And again, if you would like to go and listen to the other broadcasts that you may have missed, just invite you to visit the website. That's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity, and look for the button that's just marked archives, and you can go in, you can find the episode or the broadcast in which you may have missed. Until then, I'm getting tongue-tied here. Until next time, there we go. Everybody, please be safe out there. Get out there and see, you know, if you spend some time under the moon and allow it to speak to you, just make note of your energies and so forth. Just be open to being directed and redirected by what's laid on your heart and so forth. So everybody be safe and take care. Good night.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding around to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, on BBS Radio TV.